advertisement of work on sexual harassment to help fuel the Me Too movement. But in 2022, she asked the New York Times to let her cover biodiversity. And for the past 3 years, she's been pursuing stories about everything from crashing salmon stocks to oil development in the Amazon. So she's also been thinking about many of the challenges to biodiversity reporting that this last session will address. So, Trim, would you like to kick us off?
Can this work?
Yes.
Thanks, you guys. We'll hopefully leave lots of time for Q&A so we can hear from the challenges that you all face. It'll hopefully transition really nicely from Benji's panel, but we're going to start off with like a little amuse-bouche for you, some stories from the field, because we could all use a little color right now and a little narrative, right? So let me just quickly introduce our panel. Jennifer Bjork, who's covered the environment for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Last year, she and her colleague Greg Stanley wrote a 9-part series on biodiversity and species loss in Minnesota. It was called The Vanishing North. And there was so much interest from readers that the paper put it out as a book. She is from rural Minnesota, and she lives in St. Paul with her husband, son, cat, and a backyard forest that she planted. Carla Mendez is an investigative and features reporter for Mongo Bay, and she's a fellow of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting Rainforest Investigations Network. Last year, she investigated accusations of fraud and land grabbing by a major palm oil company in Brazil, and her story, which ran a note in December, led to a suspension of its sustainability certificate. She's from a small town from Minas Gerais, which is a mining state in Brazil, and she lives in Rio with her dog, Cacao. She was previously a business reporter, but a trip to the Amazon, which I believe had something to do with SEJ, totally changed her path. And David Quammen writes magazine stories and books. He's published 17 books, most recently Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. His new book is coming out in a month, and it draws from 20 years of reporting on biodiversity. It's called The Heartbeat of the Wild, Dispatches from Landscapes of Wonder, Peril, and Hope. He's from Cincinnati and lives in Bozeman with his wife, 3 wolfhounds, a cat, and a snake. So we're gonna start off with our little lightning round of stories in which each of you, you know, were working on a story related to biodiversity, and there was a lesson in there for you. So Jennifer, why don't we start off with you?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for making it to the last panel. I know everybody's getting a little snoozy. There were so many lessons in this. It was a pretty amazing and transforming project. I think a very simple lesson is if you're going to go out looking for a Canada lynx in the winter in northern Minnesota, be sure you get the right snowshoes. I bought a $50 job from Dick's Sporting Goods, and I went out and I just about had a heart attack. It was impossible. And the wildlife biologist I went out had these enormous old-fashioned wooden snowshoes that worked beautifully, and I was very jealous of his snowshoes. But there was a little bit of lack of planning on my part on what it would take to go through waist-high snow.
Hi everyone, it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, no, as Katrin mentioned, that SEJ really played a key role in the transition because I was a business reporter for many years, and I was at SEJ 6 years ago in a panel after doing my first trip to the Amazon that was funded by an SEJ grant. So I highly encourage you to apply for reporting grants because it can be really transformative in your lives. And really, I always say that the Amazon changed my life, and that's true because I come from a very small town. And at that part, surprisingly, I didn't have too much contact to nature. I only started having more this connection, and the previous panel talked about a lot about that when I was in my 20s. And since I became an environmental journalist, I've learned too much. I feel really blessed. Because especially being from a developing country that was colonized, we grew up in an environment with a lot of prejudice terms against the regional Native people. And I'd like to mention especially a project that we published 2 years ago that was funded by the Tirza Center, at the time I was a grantee, about indigenous people in urban areas. And at the time, the name that I gave to the project was Urban Indigenous. And it's been during the Pirza Center, the people working with me, until I talked to a sociologist that told me, hey, don't use that term, because if you say urban indigenous, you're doing a segregation. And urban, no, indigenous are indigenous people, regardless of where they live. And I never forgot that, never forget that. And like, beyond that, so in the previous panel, also someone talked about taking care of all the terms we use in our reporting, to not feel prejudice or like putting species in a bad category. So I think that's one of the big lessons in terms that we use, like Indians, tribes, anthropologists, and sociologists, they keep urging us to not use that because it's a term from colonizers. And after that, I never used that. And I was an editor with Mongabay before coming back to full-time reporting, and I always did that when I was editing the text from the reporters and putting comments. Please don't use this term, I learned this from anthropologists, because this just keep reproducing.
Does this one work too? Works?
Yes.
Lesson, mine is practical and logistical. In the same spirit as Jennifer's, and it also involves footwear. 23 years ago, I did an assignment for National Geographic that involved walking for weeks and weeks through the Congo forest with a crazed, wonderful American ecologist, conservationist named Mike Fay. And the assignment was to follow him for stretches of days as he did a 2,000-mile biological survey hike, surveying the biological diversity of the last great intact forest blocks in Central Africa from the northeastern Republic of Congo across the Gabon to the Atlantic Ocean. So I was assigned to write 3 stories. I made 4 trips with him, each for about 10 days or 2 weeks of walking. And I learned very quickly in the first 3 days or so, walking off trail, walking through swamps, walking across blackwater streams, just walk following a compass line, staying away from trails, staying away from villages, staying away from people, just wonderfully immersed in biological diversity in the Congo forest. And I learned quickly, get rid of the long pants, the nice tropical poplin pants. I threw them into the campfire on about the 3rd night. Get rid of the hiking boots. I gave my hiking boots to one of the African fellows who was part of his travel crew, his field crew. And I switched to river sandals and river shorts, which was what Mike Fay was using, and he was very experienced on long walks through the Congo forest. Skin is ultimately easier to keep clean and dry than any kind of material. So I switched to the river sandals and the shorts, and before I had gone off, National Geographic had sent me a huge bag of medical supplies, first aid supplies, insect repellent, EpiPens, if I got anaphylactic shock from a wasp sting or something, all this stuff. Didn't need any of it. I discovered that if you have a little bottle of iodine, a little package of bandages, band-aids, and a roll of duct tape, and your river shorts, and your river sandals, all the rest that you really need is a Ziploc bag big enough to hold a notebook and a ballpoint pen. And once I figured that out, I could walk wherever he was walking and scribble my notes at night in the tent. I was much better off.
As long as you're not allergic to bee stings. We're going to dig into some of these challenges that we found. We chatted, we talked about the challenges that we have encountered, building on what was discussed in the last panel. And one of them that came up was actually climate change in terms of biodiversity reporting. So climate change obviously dominates environmental reporting, and we find that that's been kind of a mixed bag for biodiversity stories. Of course, climate change contributes to biodiversity loss, but you know, as many of you all will know, it's the third driver, right? After, you know, what we can essentially call habitat destruction, you know, land and sea use change, as Edda says, and hunting and fishing are what they call direct take, right? So climate change comes in third. You would hope that, like, increased focus on climate change would actually bolster biodiversity coverage, but we haven't found that always to be the case. So David, I would love to hear from you on, like, how have you seen this? You've been covering biodiversity for a long time, and you've been able to, you've been there as the climate narrative has become more and more dominant. How have you, talk a little bit about that and tell us sort of how you deal with it now.
Well, I wrote my first story, magazine story, about the extinction crisis, I think in 1981. And around the same time, we were starting to hear about the greenhouse effect, and it was an exotic idea at that point. And I started thinking, well, maybe I should write a story about the greenhouse effect, too. And I never did. I continued to write about the problem of extinction of species, problem of loss of biological diversity, and then climate change became more and more recognized, more and more severe, more and more upon us, more and more a concern to a lot of people. Eventually, as Katrin has said, sort of subsuming everything, getting to the point where a lot of people think that climate change is the problem that subsumes the others, like loss of biological diversity, like the problem of emerging diseases and pandemic threats. And that it's all contained within climate change. But it's not, and we have to explain to people, and I do, and my colleagues do, I'm sure, that no, loss of biological diversity, climate change is a huge problem. Loss of biological diversity is also a huge problem. Emerging diseases, and the drivers that cause new viruses to emerge, the human activities that cause new viruses to emerge and turn into pandemics, is also a huge problem. I talk about those as three big, brown, churning, murky rivers of woe that are flowing parallel, with some channels interconnecting them, but flowing parallel independently to a great degree, but coming from the same source, coming from a snowfield on a big mountain that is melting. And that melting snowfield is driving these three big problems. What's melting the snowfield? What's melting the snowfield is human population size multiplied by consumption. The human footprint is squashing these three, now I'm mixing metaphors, is melting that snowfield and causing these three rivers of woe to flow. And just explaining that to people, putting it that way, I found is helpful in restoring the biodiversity crisis to its proper relationship to the others.
It's interesting that you mentioned population right off the bat. I was going to come to it a little later, but you know, I think that it's arguably a third rail on this beat, right? Because of the history of racism and oppression that has historically accompanied concerns about.
Which is why I carefully say population multiplied by consumption.
Right. No, I mean, I was prepared to come to it a little later, and like, I actually want to quote from a story that my colleague Daniel Victor wrote when the UN announced, you know, that we had reached 8 billion people. He wrote, until 1804, fewer than 1 billion people roamed our planet. More than a century later, in 1927, we crossed to 2 billion. Since then, the world population has shot up in the shape of a hockey stick, boosted by the triumphs of modern medicine and public health. The latest marker was passed on Tuesday when the United Nations said the world population had reached 8 billion just 11 years after it passed 7 billion, right? So the trajectory is so dramatic. I mean, and I feel like a lot of us learned about sort of exponential growth during COVID, right? And how that plays out. So And as you mentioned, it's important to note that these 8 billion people do not consume in the same way that people in the global north are consuming at extraordinary, really quite mind-boggling levels. People, us, here in this room, and other people consume very little by comparison. And that's both in terms of like fossil fuels and other natural resources, right? So I guess anyone can grab this one who feels so compelled to, but like, how do you deal with these issues in your reporting? It's a really important part of the equation, and it's also really, really delicate. Carl?
I think that one of the things that I always try to do in my investigative reporting is that to track the supply chains and to show that everyone, everything we consume, it can have an effect for everyone else. So we know there is a lot of greenwashing and a lot of beautiful speeches saying, no, I do sustainable business and go for the business, is that true? So behind this increase of consumption, more than ever we need a very conscious consumption of products and media's population. We need to call for accountability, responsibility from the companies, and at the same time we also need to comply with this role. As Catherine mentioned recently, I did this long investigation about palm oil in Brazilian Amazon. It's a very important issue because it's not the main driver of deforestation. You know, we talk about mining, cattle, but it's triggering a lot of problems there. So we see indigenous people dying because of water contamination, we see this, all the things. And the second top exporter, they have this RSPO, sustainability certification, and exporting this. And where this product goes? It goes mostly to Europe and the US. So who is buying these products from? It's mostly from Brazil, Africa, Asia. These countries have to be accountable for that. So each of us has to play an active role.
It really brings us back to this idea of relationships that keeps coming up again and again on the panels, right? Making these relationships between how behavior decision making in one place is affecting another place. Did you want to add anything, Jennifer?
I know. I was waiting for the idea of human consumption patterns to come up in relation to biodiversity, because it's primarily about habitat loss, and most of that is our land use decisions, and a lot of that is tied to how we live our lives and the heavy consumption. And we see that so heavily in our state of Minnesota. The southern half of the state is completely farmed to an extraordinary degree, and we used to have about 18 million acres of long, tall prairie in Minnesota, and we have less than 1% of that now. And there's a real crisis, a tremendous biodiversity loss in the southern part of the state. What we're growing primarily corn and soybeans is going to cattle feed, and it's going to ethanol and biodiesel fuel for our vehicles. And it's taking a huge toll on the environment. We have a serious problem with nitrate contamination of groundwater, drinking water and surface waters, particularly in that southern half of the state, as a result of the fertilizers and manure that spread on the fields. It's something that we are already reporting on and have reported on for years and keep reporting on. It does get tricky to not make it look like we hate our farmers, and you want to report on it sensitively, but you also have to look at who is responsible for making those decisions. They're stuck in a type of industrial agriculture. The system has been very hard to break. Greg has written some stories, my colleague Greg, who I worked on a series with, way out there, Greg, has worked on stories about curanza, which is a perennial grain to grow in place of the annual crop rotations so that you're not churning up the soil as much. It's been very difficult to get farmers to plant it because there isn't a solid market for it. But it's an example of changing this one small little piece of our consumption that we would change is by using this grain to cook with, as opposed to other things that we would grow and ship overseas, you know, for hog feed.
Did you want to add anything? I just shift gears quickly, and this came up in the last panel a bit, but like getting and keeping people's attention, right, is so hard right now, especially for publications that are not as focused on, you know, environmental issues. I have long, you know, said, well, narrative is gonna save us. You just use narrative and surprise your readers. But I feel like, it's really hard. There's so much, these tools are being used by everyone, including like the TikTok folks are using that, and they have these like candy-sized little portions that they just dole us out, right? So I would love to kind of go around and hear people, like, what are your latest and greatest strategies for bringing, you know, this particular topic, which often these narratives can feel a little familiar, right? That's, to be totally honest, this is what like stopped me from coming to this topic earlier, was I was like, I don't know how I can make, like, I don't know how, these other stories are over here are way more easy. Like, these are easier stories to make interesting than these stories. And so I would love to hear your tips for really grabbing people. Carla, I think you have some.
Yeah, I think that's for all of us journalists, because we do a hard work, we want to be read, felt, heard. And I can share with you a little bit of the experience we do at Mongo Bay, of course. That's an environmental focused website. People who get there are interested in the topics. But still, if you think about mostly of the work I do, investigative reporting usually is like bad news that a lot of people were getting away from it. But then how to engage people with that. So coming back again to connections, like showing how the thing that we're talking about connects to them. And what we've been doing, especially for long pieces, is that kind of unpacking it a bit. Like there was a palm oil piece I wrote, it was a 10,000 word piece, one of the longest and all the way. If you look at the people who really read that, I cannot require everyone to read it, but then what we did, we kind of unpacked it in different posts, like they have a video piece, they have a maps, multimedia, so we do a Twitter thread. Unfortunately, it's a lot of work, so the social media team has to go to TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn, and all of that. So we have a chance to reach different audience. But at the same time, the traditional writing that I think most of us here are working on is still key to have a long piece. And with all the pieces together, because this word can be used, especially to have prosecutors and to make changes. And in this case, for example, this palm oil land grab investigation I published in December, in February, the palm oil company had its RSPO certificate suspended. And I got access to documents showing that the investigation was key. I was, Mongo Bay and myself, we were coded, the emails I got access, saying that they reached out to people in the field. So like, it's so heartwarming when you see a direct impact of that. A previous investigation did also in palm oil about water contamination was help prosecutors to get a court decision that they were trying to get for 8 years. So like, I think that's, well, in a way, it's a lot of work. In another way, for a market that we know several outlets are laying off and people are losing their jobs, it also creates opportunities to have people to work on these different packages, to be eaten. First of all, who our audience is, what they want.
I guess the latest tactic that I have found myself using to write about biological diversity and get the story to a wide audience in a way that is fresh has happened almost accidentally and unconsciously. The last three biological diversity stories that I've written have been one about the global trade in pangolins, another about the abuse of raccoon dogs, and the third, which is an op-ed coming out in the New York Times maybe Sunday, about how avian influenza is not just threatening humans and mammals, but is also killing off a lot of wild birds, including California condors. And so the general fact is that I've been writing about biological diversity in the context of global pandemic. The general principle, I guess if there is one, is to make an effort to connect loss of biological diversity to the whole elaborate, intricate scheme of interconnected, previous panel talked a lot about relationships, interconnections, relationships among this particular species of individuals living in this room, us humans, and everything else on this planet, including coronaviruses. Do coronaviruses count as biological diversity?
I bet a scientist says they do.
Yeah, I think so too. So for me, that's been it. A piece in the New Yorker about the evolution of the SARS-CoV-2 genome and what it may have had to do with recombination with a pangolin virus and raccoon dogs being trafficked to a market in the city of Wuhan that may very well have had to do with this spillover of this virus. And now as we start to be concerned about H5N1 avian influenza as well as COVID, the fact that we shouldn't just be worrying that it might kill us, but it is also the worst thing that has happened already, the worst thing that has happened to wild birds since DDT.
One thing that I'm hearing in that I think is really applicable for probably lots of folks here in the audience is like taking whatever these moments in the global conversation. Of course, the pandemic gave like a really, was a big open door for that. But even, I'm sure there's other ways that you can take what's happening in the big public conversation and then relate it to biodiversity. Is that right? I mean, that's like one strategy to sort of get people to hang on to it, to convince editors probably also to take stories.
Yeah, the history of planet Earth is the rise and fall of biological diversity. Everything else is a subcategory of that.
Well, I agree. We just have to convince everyone else, right? Did you have anything to add, Jennifer, to this one?
I guess we were talking about what our latest, greatest strategies are for getting the compelling stories. And oh, look, I have a copy of that book with me. So our newspaper is very easy to sell, $14.99. Hopefully by the end of the week they'll be down in the bookshop, but you can always get them at the Star Tribune, StarTribune.com shop. That's all in there. So one of the things that became really apparent when we were working on this series, and each installment was a different species, plants, insects, fish, birds, mammals, was what really struck Greg and I was how much work it took to set it up, each installment. And what we were trying to get at was the relationship between the people who are working on with these species and restoration of their ecosystem or just rescuing them from the brain. We were working on their time schedule. So as a reporter, you can't just call them up and you get the story. You have to find the researchers who are working on this species, I guess identify good species, but then find the people who are working on them, and then their work determines your reporting completely. And so in the case of the pouched skipperling butterfly, which is literally on the verge of extinction, used to be a very common butterfly in Minnesota, there are only a couple of hundred left, and a researcher at the zoo in our state was working on them. And they froze the caterpillars over winter. The caterpillars naturally freeze. They survive Minnesota winters. And so the timing of the story was, well, when do they take those caterpillars out of the freezer so that we can see these frozen, tiny little green caterpillars thawing and then starting to eat immediately the plants. So there was a lot of waiting and a lot of timing because they don't know exactly when the caterpillars are ready to thaw. It has a lot to do with a lot of different things. And the day the caterpillars were ready to come out of the freezer and thaw happened to be the same day that another installment of this series on a native blackberry called a bristleberry, the plant group was going out to dig up these plants and rescue them from a highway project and move them to a location where they could survive. And so it happened on the same day. And so it's like, I couldn't be in two places at once. Greg, thank God, was so skilled, jumped in and went and handled the caterpillars being defrosted, and I ran off to the bristleberries and worked on that story. Just the lesson is just that finding that human story and the people working on these species really means going with their schedule. And at times I felt like I had a spreadsheet going of where each project was at, so I know when do I jump in and bring the photographer and go get the action and what they're doing. And it also prevented the natural optimism of these researchers and scientists and conservationists and volunteers working on these species carried the stories. We didn't need to talk about hope. It was just there in what they were doing. They refused to give in to despair. And the work that they were doing was just incredibly inspiring, and it's infectious. You just come away jazzed in spite of the dire straits of some of the species. That is, we can do something.
Questions? Over there.
My name is Zoe. I'm a reporter for Grist. I hope Grist isn't monopolizing the questions here, but this is gonna be quick. I don't know if it's controversial, but in my head there's almost like a hierarchy of importance, right? With climate change and biodiversity, and it feels like there's this understanding of climate change as being sort of like up here and biodiversity sort of like falling down on the ladder of what's important, which we know to be not true. And I think one way around that is just this understanding that climate change, you know, does affect biodiversity in myriad ways, and I don't want to bastardize your metaphor, David, about the rivers, but one of the ways that I've found that I can write about this climate change / biodiversity overlap is by focusing on health. And I guess I'm wondering, what are some more channels between these two issues? Because it feels like they don't need to be in tension with each other. They can work symbiotically, and there may be ways to lift up those biodiversity stories by linking them to this climate issue that does appear to have some more relevance with readers.
Thank you for that. I'll say something about that, but only a partial answer. Linking it to health. I mean, health is certainly one of the channels interconnecting these things. I mean, we know in terms of the climate change stories that intertwine with those other two rivers I've mentioned, the spread northward and southward of disease-carrying vector invertebrates is very high on the list. A lot more people are going to be exposed to malaria and to dengue in coming years than in the past because of climate change, because those vectors are moving north and south into areas where they can now survive. In terms of biological diversity, how do you link that? Well, frankly, I don't know. I'm gonna pass it off to my fellow panelists. Again, part of it is the movement of species, the movement of exotic species. We all know that invasive species, exotic species, are one of the drivers of loss of biological diversity, and that we have a small number of, and to go back to something that I wrote 20 years ago, weedy species. Weedy species of animals and plants that are spreading and spreading all the more now because of human activities, including climate change. And when you have a broadly adapted weedy species of animal or plant that comes into an area where there are narrowly adapted local endemic species and populations, you tend to lose biological diversity. I think that tangle of things is one step toward calling attention to what you're saying. At least I hope it is.
I'm going to join them for a minute. I'm really newer at this probably than like lots of you, right? Because I've been just doing this since like the end of 2020. But when I was pitching this beat and talking about this beat, like I was surprised by how many people just thought that biodiversity loss was caused by climate change, period. And so I have really gone, I've really tried to remind people about habitat loss, just because A, it's such a big driving factor, and B, it's also like one way that animals are going to be able to adapt to climate change, right? Like without the habitat for them to find, it's really bad. I mean, just in this story I did just now, when you know California's canceling its salmon fishing because there's not enough salmon. You know, it was really interesting talking to some of the scientists who are working on that. And I mean, it's basically like salmon's only shot is to just give them like tons of habitat so that like at least they're going to kind of find their way. And of course we're limiting their options on all fronts. So I guess there's a way to take climate change and maybe tie it into some of those other driving causes of biodiversity.
One's in the audience. Okay. I wonder where our microphones were going. The other point of interconnection that occurred to me is fragmentation of habitat, and the way insularization of species and populations leads to extinction, leads to loss of biological diversity, and the way climate change exacerbates the problem of fragmented habitats. You've got ecological islands with names such as the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, and you have animals and plants that can't follow their preferred habitat as their preferred habitat is moved north. Their preferred climatic conditions are moved north by climate change. Crows and ravens can move north out of the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, but grizzly bears can't get across Interstate 90, four lanes of traffic and a concrete divider, with any great level of success. And white bark pine, a very important species that's part of the grizzly's 230-some food items, one of the four most important food items of the grizzly bear in the Yellowstone ecosystem. White bark pines, which produce these little nuts that are rich in fat that grizzlies eat in the fall, white bark pines are dying out, disappearing from the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem in the areas above 8,000 feet where they grow because of climate change, and they can't move north either. So that problem, fragmentation of habitat as well as the loss of habitat, certainly contributes in synergy with climate change to the loss of biological diversity.
Bethany Waller, Society for Ecological Restoration. I was really glad to hear you guys talk about population, and I guess I have maybe a not fair question, but I'm not sure. There's a lot of reporting outside of the environmental space about these catastrophes that are happening when populations are starting to shrink in places like China and Japan, and even potentially the United States if we didn't have so much immigration. And it's a catastrophe that our population is shrinking. And we never talk about the fact that it's a catastrophe that our population is growing. And so how do you, as environmental journalists, work with your economic growth journalists and partners to try to temper this fear of a declining population? Because our entire economic system is built on growth, and our planet is going to crash based on that growth, and we don't talk about that.
I can start. This is a hard one, and we convey feedback to the business desk and to other desks on stories. You'll see that some of our very aware of some of the stories that you're talking about. I was talking to Inger Anderson at one point, who runs the UNEP, and when she was asked for the solution, like, what's the solution to the biodiversity crisis? She said, the circular economy. And so I think that, like, that is one way to think about, because someone else said, was it Michelle? It's like, taking down capitalism, I don't know that that's a tough one. But thinking about a circular economy really modeled on nature's own cycles is one way to think about sort of how to make our economy more sustainable, right? And I think that, like, I don't even know, like, how much that idea of a circular economy has kind of penetrated, like, the public. I think, you know, in certain, like, you know, Apple is definitely celebrating and, you know, talking about all its, how circular it's trying to make its cell phones. But outside of the sort of, like, business realm, I'm not sure how much people are actually thinking about it.
Yeah, I agree, that's a tough topic, and I think that we don't really cover this much, but there was a podcast that MongoBay released in the last month that was really engaging. It was about that, of not having kids. So, like, Mike G, that's our host, and it was a success. So I think there is an opportunity there to talk about more of the things. And of course that I can tell from a developing country what's behind that. I can tell you that I don't have kids, many of my friends don't have kids, and this has to do for women perspective. This change of working and independent here in the US a bit different. As you know, I think the tasks at home are completely divided. But in Brazil and other countries where all falls into women, many women simply don't want to have kids because I want my career, I don't have to have extra work. So I think there is a lot of nuances on that we need to shed a light
on. I'll just say something and be honest, I just don't think our newspaper has ever covered it that way. My editor and my colleague Greg are here, correct me if I'm wrong, but population, other than maybe migration and some census data, I just don't think we have looked at that in terms of the environment and biodiversity at all. And it's a great opportunity, and I'll come away with that's, that's going to brew now. I'm brewing a story, and something will come of it. I have to find what's really happening out there. I can't just think this story, but I'm sure there's something going on about that, and I'll find it.
And just to add, sorry, as you talked about the census, the story that I talked about the urban indigenous that became indigenous in Brazilian cities, what we did, we really desiccated the census data and showed, and I think that's an opportunity to maybe replicate it everywhere else, showing where they really live. Because through the census, there is a lot of data, we just have the general things, but what we did a rank of the cities with the highest population of indigenous people. And we showed, for example, Rio, it's the most famous Brazilian city. It's the fourth Brazilian city with the indigenous population in 2010 census. And people are so surprised about that. And we could track that information down for neighborhood. And it interacted maps showing that. So I think in terms of native populations, there is an opportunity for us to show, because especially the ones who live in cities, they are completely the most invisible ones. So I think there is a information and census. I think you have a lot of information.
I just want to add something that's maybe not directly responsive to your question, but since the circular economy has been mentioned and Apple has been mentioned, I can't resist saying something about the battery economy and cobalt and coltan mining in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. If anybody here, some enterprising, brave, francophone, youngish journalist wants a great story, go to the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, to where cobalt and coltan are being mined to supply the batteries in all of our devices, including our electric cars, as well as our phones and our computers, and see the child labor and the loss of life that's going into the production of cobalt and coltan for our uses, for our convenience, and write about that. And while you're at it, look into what those people are eating out there. Those Congolese men, women, and children who are living in their little villages with these big cobalt and coltan mines, opening up in the earth, some of it shaft mining and some of it open pit mining, with, again, children being killed daily in shaft cave-ins. They are living there, but they are making $1 a day, $2 a day, $5 a day, if they're very lucky. And here's the point that particularly interests me, but I'm way too old to go and do this story now, and I'm not Francophone enough. What are they eating? What are they doing for protein? They're presumably eating a lot of wildlife. What's one consequence of that? They're exposing themselves to new viruses, novel viruses. Here I go again on viruses. Porcupines, bats, civets of various different sorts, exposing themselves on our behalf to novel viruses that could kill them and could spread worldwide. I mention this whenever somebody asks me, well, why should I feel concerned about the problem of emerging diseases and the drivers and the causes of that? Because I don't eat bats. I don't eat raccoon dogs. So I'm not driving that problem. And I say, have you got a smartphone? Have you got a computer? If so, you're a customer for cobalt and coltan that is being produced by these people, and they are the ones who are at the interface point exposing themselves to these new diseases on your behalf, as well as living miserable lives to make a few bucks to try and feed themselves and their families. So the downside of the all-electric circular economy.
You're recovering the minerals, and so you're not having to mine them. But, I mean, look, this transition that we're making now to for EVs is, there's very ugly sides to that, right, as necessary. Yeah. Other questions?
Hi, Adam Glenn. I edit the SE Journal for the Society of Environmental Journalists. I have a question that has to do with form of storytelling. And I hate to follow up with a food-related comment before I do, but the other day as I was eating my strawberry Nutri-Grain bar, I looked down at the package and it was strawberry and squash. And, you know, the six-year-old in me said, ooh. And then I realized that I couldn't taste the squash and it was nutritious and I like squash anyway. So there's a point to this. The moderator commented about the candy of various social media formats. I think you picked on TikTok, which I don't use very much. But aren't we missing out on something when, and I'm a word guy, you know, from the beginning, but we think mostly about long form and just getting more and more information and insight and narrative into what we do. I don't suggest that TikTok or those social forms are the end point, but as a doorway into deeper information. Aren't there, maybe from the panel or others, in your inspiration for how to turn TikTok into a strawberry squash internet bar?
Oh my God, TikTok, you guys. TikTok, it's so addictive. If you should spend some time on it, because you'll see how addictive it is. What I struggle with, I think, yes, lean into TikTok, how to do it without, you know, there's all different kinds of journalists in this room, right? But I work at the New York Times, so that's a very certain kind of journalism, and I think it's hard to really ride, you have to be more opinionated to really rise on social media, right? That's what Twitter likes, well, you know, RIP, I don't know, but that's like TikTok, you need to have like a really tight take. And so, yes, it's grabby. What I'm concerned about is, I don't know, just thinking about what Christina was saying earlier about like black and white thinking and leaving room for nuance and actually remembering that things aren't black and white, that is what really gets lost, right? I think we need to do all of it, right? Like, I think it's just like an all of the above kind of thing, but that to me is one of the big dangers of TikTok or, and the like.
Just earlier, I think I mentioned this in the previously, that's for example, Monga Bay. Monga Bay went to TikTok. So people were looking at it, we need to go, but we do our environmental content. So,
the whole thing?
No. TikTok is just yeah. So that's, I think it goes again towards unpacking, and of course, population getting older, we need to look at the new generation. What, where are they getting information? And we need to get them. So it's not, we cannot require them to consume news as we guys have been doing. Things change. And I think for to succeed, we need to adapt to it. It's a lot of work. Then you see now, like on Twitter, that's completely crazy with these algorithms. It happened on Facebook. One thing that we've been doing is that, and long again, without not we do an analysis. I think all let's do that, like page views and that, but beyond page views. For us, what really matters is to see how long people spend on a story, how many people go to the end, and impact. Because if you show that our work is generating impact and sharing that, especially for us as a nonprofit, it helps us to get funding, to keep doing the work you do. Like today, like I sent the guys home, Monga Bay was quoted several times during the Global Forest Watch presentation. So we keep track of all that. So it's about quality. I know that for a more general newspapers like the Times, it's different. But for Monga Bay, for example, we're really focused on the quality of our products. We are on TikTok too.
Hi. Getting back to the population question, one of the reasons why I think population and consumption have become a third rail for so many journalists is that after Paul Ehrlich brought it to attention as an environmental problem in the late 60s, it became associated with draconian immigration restrictions or coercive restrictions on reproduction, you know, neither of which, they not only caused appalling violations of human rights, but they didn't work. And now we know that what works to reduce family size is girls' education, healthcare for women, access to reproductive services, including abortion. And that makes me wonder, I think there's a story that we don't tell as environmental journalists about the connection. David, you've talked a lot about the connection between disease and biodiversity. We don't tell the story about girls' education, reproductive care, health education. We don't tell the story between those things and biodiversity. And I wonder if any of you have collaborated with colleagues on the health or education desks, see an opportunity to do that.
Corongosa National Park tells that story. And you'll see a little bit more about it tonight. And there's a piece on it, in the new book of mine that Catherine mentioned, the piece I did on Corongosa for National Geographic. It's reprinted there. And you heard about it from Gabby a little bit earlier. Gorongosa National Park is a paradigm for the world in terms of thinking about those things together.
But it's also tricky when, you know, to what Bethany said, then these declines get framed in a negative way.
last question from journalists too. So if there are any journalists that want a question, Steve.
Thanks, just Chip Barber, W. A really quick follow-up to you, David, about the cobalt and coltan. You, I'm sure, are well aware of what's happening in the Pacific Ocean. They're talking about going down and doing deep seabed mining, and one of the rationales for that is it will have a lot less environmental impact because you won't have to get it from the eastern DRC and places like that. I'm just curious what you think about that whole debate.
I'm not up to speed on that debate, but I will be this time tomorrow. So thank you for that word.
I'm not a super expert on it, but there's a loophole in the law of the Sea Convention, which now we would vote, which said if you don't come up with a plan for going after all the manganese and coal and all the stuff which is down there, it, a license will be allowed. And there's a company which is ready to do this. And a number of the car companies, the big car companies, BMW and Mercedes, have said, we won't buy this stuff from the deep sea because we don't have the environmental impacts. But the argument is, well, they're pretty bad on land, too. Maybe it's better we do it, you know, in the deep ocean out there in the middle. In, you know, in the middle, and people are really grappling with those two sides of it, you know, which is worse, basically.
It sounds like a great story for somebody to start thinking about tonight. And I don't mean to say that in a cynical way, but just it's important and it's complex, including morally complex. That really sounds like a valuable thing for all of us to know about and to be curious about and to look into. Thanks.
I think we're
going to
take one more question here, and then Pat can probably
jump. Hi, thanks to all of you. This was a great session. I'm Sonia, and I'm from California, and a couple of things that came up were, you know, how to get readers or viewers to really understand and care about these issues. You know, one of the things I've tried is immersive video. I tried a 360-degree video, but the thing is, a lot of my viewers, you know, I'm a radio journalist and also do video for NPR and PR as a world, are, a lot of my audience members already care about the planet. They care about the environment. They want to make an impact. They want to consume these stories. How do you propose reaching the other half of the country? You know, the people that don't think climate change is real, the Fox News audience base, the people that probably are not reading Monga Bay, which I'm a big fan of, and the New York Times and Star Tribune. So how do you reach that other segment of the population, which I find also difficult to do as someone who works for public radio, for NPR and PRI. The question about girls' education was really intriguing, because that's also one of my beats. I cover how women and the environment are connected. So just to answer that one question was, you know, a lot of NGOs like the Sierra Club are actually starting to look at that, and I've been able to get great information on how, you know, increasing reproductive rights and awareness among girls and women around the world is actually helping the environment in a lot of the global south. So, you know, look for those kinds of NGOs like the Sierra Club that have actually started entire departments looking at that issue. But I just wanted to ask you, how do you propose reaching the climate deniers in the U.S. and the world?
You know, I've been covering this for several years now, and I honestly have very few. I mean, we're a local paper, right? Minnesota, we're of the state, but you know, that's our audience. And I have had very few climate deniers reach out to me. It's, I think things are changing. I think it's entered the mainstream. I don't think the denial is what it was. I'm not saying it's not there, it's there, but I would be hearing a lot more about it, I'm sure, because they all have my phone number and my email, and I get, you know, I hear from the public all the time. That's just not, it's just not happening.
Yeah, well, I don't have good news to share. To reach the people who deny, it's really tough, because we experienced this in Brazil during the last 4 years when Bolsonaro was in government. They just denied everything, and we really saw coming to the surface a lot of people supporting that idea. So I can tell that even family and friends, I literally give up. I don't have the power to convince them. It's like, it's the same thing like a right wing and left. But of course, as a journalist, we need to have hope in this way, I think, to bit by bit try to get ways to get this audience. But when a person really have this preconception, the earth is flat and all that, is really difficult for us to really don't know how to do with it. But maybe trying to do more and more stories showing the real effect on their lives. When we had, for example, just at the start of the Bolsonaro government, we had big fires in the Amazon and people kind of denying it, including the government. And then that smoke reached São Paulo. So like all the media, I think the photos were really impressive and people talking about it. That was really a real proof of how things are connecting and can be affect and can also has connection to health, because if that smoke of pollution gets to cities, people get, not in cities but in the forest, everyone is getting sick about that. And so coming back, for example, health, that was really a topic everyone talking about. I think we really need to work, do a better job on doing these connections, because I think health is something that everyone cares about. Then it's connection to food. And for example, the use of pesticides in agriculture and the way that things have been expanding, it's really frenetic and without control, and this affects us. But then, okay, you say, oh, we're organic, but the cost of that in most places is really expensive. So we need to require, like, and we need a governmental will, of course, but also try initiatives to buy directly from producers and all that. But if you look, the scale is small. So, like, but I think there is some alternatives to try to.
One of us should be writing about what the insurance industry thinks about climate change for the Wall Street Journal. And one of us should be writing about what the Department of Defense thinks about the climate change for foreign affairs. And one of us should be writing about what hunters and fishermen think about climate change and its impacts on elk and on trout and on ducks for outdoor life, Field and Stream, and American Angling.
Well, I will just end by saying that I hope we continue these conversations over the next few days and that we keep grappling with this. One thing that I really take away from today is the importance of relationships, thinking about healthy relationships and unhealthy relationships. And just with like newsrooms, like another example of that Michelle's comment, you know, brings up is just like this, we're so siloed, right? So the business desk is, you know, there are environmental publications, but even in, you know, publications like the New York Times, like we're so siloed and trying to create some more relationships where some may not exist. So thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to you all for
thank you. Many, many thanks to all of our speakers and for joining us here today. We've appreciated the conversations you've heard today. I will remind you, this is a conference by journalists for journalists. It's really run on volunteer power. Success really depends on all of us coming up with ideas and pitching panels and bringing our expertise to our peers. So we will be sending out a call for pitches in about 6 months for the next conference. So I hope you'll consider bringing your own ideas and energy and expertise to the next conference.
And Jenny, thank you for coordinating all this.
Thank you. Continually improve on the conference. And the networking event will begin soon. soon in the Jordan Ballroom at 3:30. So feel free to head there, get a drink, some snacks. And don't forget, 4 o'clock, Global Forest Watch, Deep Dive in Barnwell. Feel free to take your snacks there if you're interested in doing that. And thanks again, and enjoy the rest of the conference. Bye.
Yeah.